if you happen to understand Russian and you look at the nose of the airplane, the name of that airplane is in Russian. This was the airplane, the first DC-3 sold to Russia. They also were a licensee of ours, and typical of the Soviet Union in the Stalinist era, they really named it the Li-2 and claimed, of course, they invented it. The salesman for this airplane was James Roosevelt, son of the president. And we also have not been paid by the Russians. And we figure it's about $100 billion if they pay us up. Next slide. Oh, by the way, the one modification the Russians made inside the airplane, because it's so damn cold in Siberia, is they actually had a cold stove in the airplane with a stovepipe going up and facing aft through the roof, and they had a trooper in there behind throwing in lumps of coal. This is the picture of the world-famous DC-2.5. If you look at the wings, they're not the same length. Due to Japanese activities in China, the one wing was badly damaged, and so just unscrew the wing and screw it on a DC-2 wing, so we now have the world-famous and one and only DC-2.5. Next slide. I put this picture in, of course, because it's a C-47. It has the left-hand door for paratroopers to step out for lunch, and it has, of course, the navigation dome. If you look in the background, you don't see any houses. If you look in the background now, you don't see any land. Next slide, please. Here is the secret of World War II. America's best kept secret, and that is Rosie the Riveter. They made all the difference in the world. By the way, that is the Long Beach facility. You look up and you see a bright lit, higher metal ceiling. Next slide. This, of course, is the production line. We cock the airplanes, not because we're cockeyed, it's because we can get better, more airplanes done inside. So they go down the production line at a slight angle that doesn't hurt the airplane much. Next. I dare anyone to find a man in this picture. That's Rosie the Riveter making the 2000th airplane at Long Beach. And there's every single person is a woman. Douglas Aircraft employed more women, over 34,000, than any other manufacturer, including ships and munitions and everything else. We were the world's leading user of females. We had a total of 96,000 people, of which 34,000 were women. Unfortunately, almost all of them got their pink slips in 1945. We just stopped the production. Next slide. Here, of course, to honor our friends the Brits, is a picture of the Dakota. Now, of course, the only difference was that it had, of course, British markings on it. I got a little story about the Brits. We made a bomber of Santa Monica called the DB-7, and the Air Force called it the A-20, and the British call it the Havoc. Now, we were making it for France, but France disappeared. It was taken over by the Germans. So we just simply switched the airplane. In fact, the DB-7s actually had the British bullets on them, markings, rather than the U.S., right at the Santa Monica facility. And since Roosevelt in 1940 and before the Japanese attack, 41, had obeyed the Neutrality Act. So the DB-7s were flown to upper New York State. They landed on a farmer's field that had been plowed flat. And then at night, those sneaky, no good Canadians / Brits would come along and steal airplanes. Next slide. Here is a picture of the creators of the plane that changed the world. From left to right, you have Raymond, Atwood, Strompel, Oswald, Kindleberger, my father, Burton, Colburn, and Moxness. These are the people. There are others, but these are basically the core of the people who actually put the airplane together from a design point of view. Next slide. I do not believe that any of us who worked on the design and development of the DC-1 and DC-2 quite realized at the time we were building the DC-3, an airplane that would outlast the careers of all of us. I think we should remember it was the skill, courage, and faith of the flyers themselves who made the DC-3 great. To paraphrase Old Man River, the DC-3 flies on and on. Who knows, possibly she will last forever. Donald Duck. Next slide. Next slide. Hello, there. And this is a picture I pinched off the internet because I don't have a picture of a DC-3 with a turboprop. And there is a DC-3 with a turboprop. And the old girl should be good for another 75. I only wish that I was. Next slide. Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen.
Jim,
thank you all for inviting me.
Thank you, Jim. Jim, before you finish, would you mind sharing that brief story that you told me about The brief story you told me about President FDR calling your home when you were a youngster?
Now he's asking for the X-rated part of the program, and there's a lot of that. It's 1943, the fall, Santa Monica, California, where we lived, at 1433 San Vicente Boulevard. I was thirsty. I woke up about 5 in the morning, which of course is 8 in the east, and I went downstairs, down the back stairs, and turned on the kitchen light, and poured myself a half glass of milk. I'm sitting there drinking it. Now, I was born and raised in the communication generation. You had 3 telephones in the house, the kitchen, the family room, dad's bedroom. We didn't take Twitter, we didn't twit, we didn't face, we didn't do anything. If you didn't talk to somebody face to face or phone them, you didn't. The phone rings. I pick it up. I mean, I'm a little over 10 years old, so yes, sir. This is the president. I must talk to your father. Now, dad ran a half dozen or so major Douglas facilities in Oklahoma, Tulsa, Chicago, Santa Monica, Culver City, West Los Angeles, and even in Eritrea and Ethiopia. In fact, Roosevelt was so mad at dad when dad said the first arsenal democracy plant in Long Beach, he made us put a factory in Ethiopia. Roosevelt never let anybody get ahead of him. So anyway, I said, yes, sir. So I put my milk down, put the phone next to the phone, not back in the cradle, went upstairs, walked to dad's bedroom, which was at the end of the hall. Nothing. Nothing. Then I reached out for the big brass doorknob, opened the door. Dad slept on his back. He wore a black eye shade so there wouldn't be light. Well, light in Santa Monica in World War II in 1943 was non-existent. But anyway, I walked over and wiggled his toe. What is it? I said, Dad, the president is on the phone. So put your fingers in the ears of all the children. Tell the old son of a bitch to call me in the morning. That's an exact quote because I was the only other person there. I said, Dad, I can't tell the president goodbye. I have to do something. He says, then the finger comes out. You go to bed and hang up the phone and don't say a word. Realizing I still had my head, I beat the hell out of there and went downstairs, finished my milk, and went to bed. That is an actual story. And
okay, well, thank you very much, Jim. We certainly enjoyed that. Henry, thank you for your history. We appreciate it very much. Thank both of you.
Thank you all.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we have some distinguished visitors with us here this evening, all of whom have experience with the DC-3 or the C-47. And I also want to ask that we please bring Mr. Paul Johns out. Mr. Johns is 97 years old. He'll be the senior member amongst us, and I'd like for him to come out on the stage too, if you would, please. The gentlemen who are here, Mr. D. Coleman is the first gentleman here, flew C-47s during World War II. Mr. Jim Gorman is next. He also flew C-47s during World War II. Mr. Gary Wiley. Gary flew the EC-47s in Vietnam. And Dr. Bernard Sand. And Dr. Sand flew the C-47 in the Pacific during World War II. So let's go ahead and begin with you, Deke, and let's talk just a minute about what your training was like back in World War II as far as training in a C-47 was concerned.
Well, I graduated from single engine advance at Luke Field in June of 44. And in October, we sat around Luke Field until October, and then they shipped to us to Laramburg Maxton Army Air Base in South Carolina. And that is a glider base. And they gave us 3 hours and 10 landings in CG-4A gliders and qualified us as glider pilots. Then they put us on the train and we went up to New York City, got on the Queen Mary, and we went to Glasgow. And from Glasgow, went down to a repo depot, and from there to the 314th Troop Carrier Group in Saltby, England. We thought we were going to fly gliders, but they said, no, you're here to fly C-47s. Well, they spent quite a while checking us out in the C-47s, and we flew C-47s until March of 45. And that was the day we towed gliders at the Rhine crossing at Wesel, Germany. And that was the only combat mission we flew. Everything else was hauling freight to and from the front lines. And we hauled everything you can imagine.
That's good. Let's talk just for a moment about the glider operations, Deke, because I think a lot of people are probably interested in that. Can you give us just a typical, let's talk about it from both ends. Let's talk about it from the glider pilot's viewpoint first, and then let's talk about it from towing, the tow pilot's perspective.
Well, we'd never even heard of the CG-4A when we got to Laramburg Maxton, and they had the field set up with barriers of shrubs at both ends of the field. And they'd tow us, and we'd cut loose, and we'd come in, and we'd land between the barriers, and they'd cover up the airspeed. They say you don't need that. And we had quite a time. We wiped out a few barriers, and but we got our 3 hours and 10 landings, and we were rated as glider pilots. And it was the landing of the CG-4A was something else. You had you come in, and you touch down. And as soon as you touched, you slammed on the brakes and shoved the wheel full forward. And the nose had skids on it, and it would go up on the nose, and it would stop that way. And that's the way that that you landed the CG-4A.
Now, didn't they go in a lot of times and snatch the gliders out with the C-47s?
Yeah, we were supposed to go in the next day after we after the Wesel Rhine crossing. But there wasn't enough left of the gliders to even think about snatching them out. We had one glider that had the reel on it that went in to snatch the gliders out.
Were the C-47s that did the towing, were they reinforced in any way that you knew, or were they just standard C-47s?
No, I think they're just standard C-47s. We had the glider had a release. After we cut the glider loose, then we go back across the Rhine to the rope drop area, and we had a release for the rope there, and there was a special area we dropped the ropes in.
I see. Okay, Jim, I know that you had a lot of experience back during World War II also, and I remember you relating a story about being a young man. I think you said you were about 19 years old, and you picked up a C-47 in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And you and your crew headed for New Guinea, is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. I was 19 going on 20, and we picked up a brand new C-47 at Fort Wayne, flew it to the West Coast, flew it to Hawaii in 17 hours, went from there to Christmas Island, to Canton Island, to Tarawa, to Guadalcanal, into Port Moresby, New Guinea, 68 hours.
So how did you navigate?
There's a thing called an ADF.
A lot of people probably haven't heard about that, Jim.
Well, the one thing you've got to remember, the Hawaiian Islands are 800 miles long, so they're pretty hard to miss.
And how many hours, again, did it take you going from the West Coast to Honolulu?
It was 17 hours.
17 hours then, huh? Any kind of weather problems?
No, we didn't have any weather problems on that flight.
How many hours did you have in the airplane when you launched out on this?
Oh, my, probably 100.
How about total time?
Oh, about 300.
You're a well-experienced pilot then, to say the least,
right.
Huh? Well, that's good, Jim. That's real good. Let's talk just a little bit about Vietnam then, Gary. The AC-47s, of course, a lot of people are familiar with that airplane. It had the gunships on it, or the Gatling guns on it. And I was in Vietnam myself, flew Caribous in the Air Force there, and I can recall we worked with Special Forces, and I recall seeing a lot of times the AC-47s coming in, and when they did, it was quite a show. And I know that the Special Forces guys loved that airplane because they were so accurate with it. But the EC-47 had a different mission, didn't it, Gary? You want to tell us a little bit about the mission it had?
Yes, it did. We were completely unarmed. We all had 38s on our hip was the amount of armament we had. But unlike Jim, I never got to fly a brand new DC-3 or an EC-47. Mine were a little older, mostly 1944 version. But I was stationed at Da Nang in 1972, 1973. And we flew a mission 9,750 feet, flew 8 hour, usually 8 hours and 10 minutes long. We flew south of Da Nang mostly, and it was a aircraft bristling with antennas. It had a lot, at the time, top secret, really sophisticated gear back then, which now they'd be joking about and laughing about compared to what they have. But we had 10 radio operators in the back end and a navigator, and we eavesdropped on enemy transmissions and translated those and actually located the transmitter. And a lot of times we'd roll off a target, and if the navigator and the crew, I'm not sure what all they were doing back there, determined that that was a really hot target, sometimes we'd roll off a target and an F-4 or another fighter would roll in on a target on our coordinates and information. A lot of the B-52 strikes in Vietnam, their intel actually came from the EC-47s flying in Vietnam. We had EC-47s airborne pretty much 24/7. There was almost always a crew flying somewhere in Southeast Asia, 9,750 feet. That was our standard altitude, and we droned around out there for hour after hour. But it was a good mission, good stable airplane, and a lot of fun to fly. I feel really honored to be up here with a lot of these gentlemen, first of all, but to be part of an incredible part of history to fly that airplane that really changed aviation. It's a pretty incredible airplane.
Absolutely. It certainly did, didn't it? Okay, Dr. San, you are a World War II veteran. You flew the C-47, and I think you told me you flew it in the Pacific. Is that correct?
Correct.
Want to tell us specifically where you were?
I was basically from New Guinea on up to the end of the war, up to Okinawa, and after the war, eventually to Japan, and even over to Shanghai. In any event, things were pretty well secured by the time I got over there, so we didn't have great problems with enemy air activity. And we spent our time hauling anything they put in the door and took it anywhere they wanted it to go, as well as hauling wounded from remote areas to base hospitals and dropping supplies to troops in remote areas that were difficult to supply by land. And we just kept busy at that all the time.
Now, where, when you were flying on all these missions and so forth, where would you stay? Do you have any kind of quarters that you stayed in when you're out traveling, or just stay with the airplane, or what'd you do?
I'm sure every outfit worked differently, but the way it was done in my squadron, when I went out on a flight, I would have a load designated to go a certain place, which I would deliver, and then I would be giving instructions for the next thing to do, and I would be gone from our base for 6 or 7 days. I would fly up to 60 hours in that period of time, and I had to be back for a special inspection on the aircraft at 60 hours. And we just stayed wherever we happened to be that night. We just stayed there, slept under the wing of the plane or in the plane if it was raining. And we were usually in the air by shortly after sunrise, and it was late at night before we got finished. So we were kept really busy for that period of time.
think I heard you mention something that you had a lot of difficulty keeping food for your crew. Is that correct?
Well, it was a problem. We didn't have good rations, and we were in the air when long before the transient camps, if there were one, was one in that area before it opened, and we were they had long since closed before we got squared away in the evening. So it was always a problem for us, and we frequently had just to eat rations or something of that sort.